Good morning, my name's Mike and I'm an alcoholic. First of all, I'd like to kind of explain the significance of this suit. There's two reasons I've got it on this morning. One, it's kind of a celebration. It's the first suit I ever owned in my life. I bought it just a little over 2 years ago when I married Lou Ann here in the front row, and she insisted that I wear a suit, and that's why we bought one. And then once again this morning, Milton and Jim here insisted that I wear a suit, so I've got one on. I'm still new enough in this program that I know when to follow directions. And I hope I stay that new. I have really enjoyed this weekend. I've enjoyed the speakers and the fellowship, and some real AA happens up here, and it doesn't happen everywhere, I don't believe. A lot of times I look for some real AA meetings. I'm always reminded of a guy that's no longer with us named Russ that used to share in meetings, and he liked to get up and say, "I'm Russ, and I'm a real alcoholic." And two things always happened when he did that. It made people think, and it made other people mad because they didn't hear him say he was a real alcoholic. They heard him say they weren't. And another thing that he used to say was he wished he could find another real alcoholic in a real AA meeting, and I believe I found several of those up here this weekend, and I appreciate that. It's always an honor to be asked to speak anywhere. It's always an honor to be anywhere, because I began to wonder if I would be anywhere a lot of days out there when I was drinking. I was talking with a fellow that I sponsor it's been about 2 years ago now, and he called me up and said, "Mike, I am really, really fed up." He said, "I'm tired of going to these speakers' meetings." He said, "If the guy starts a meeting that I'm born and raised somewhere," that he said, "I always know I'm in for a long drunk-a-log." And he said, the other phrase he hates to hear him say is I hope I won't get into a long drunk-a-log. And, you know, I agreed with him because I hate to hear one. And I'll try not to bore y'all with a long drunk-a-log today. My story goes like this. I was born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee. You see, I can't change that part of my story, and I believe that that's where my story began. I believe that's where my trouble began. I can't even remember when my trouble began. My parents have to tell me about some of it. And there was a time when I was about 2 years old that they would punish me, and the way they would punish me is that they would stand me in the corner, and I would stand there and hold my breath and puff my cheeks out until the blood blisters would bust all over my face. And I can't tell you for sure, but I feel certain that the reason I did that was because I wanted to do it my own way, and I was going to show them, and I still do that today sometimes, except I don't bust blood vessels. I was raised in one of those real loving, caring, religious families, and I was taught about love, and I didn't learn it. And I was taught about caring, and I didn't learn it. And I felt different from other people all my life. Not that I always felt less than they did. Lots of times I felt better than they were. But I never felt quite the same. I can remember times when I was probably five, maybe six, that my parents used to get together, and there were four of us, four children in our family, and there were two girls next door. These two families were real close growing up, and the parents would like to get in one house on Friday night and play penny ante poker. And the kids all got in another house, and we watched TV and played and did what kids do. And I can remember not once but several times running from the house full of kids over to the house full of parents, crying, saying that nobody loved me, even the dog bit me. And, I know today that the dog did bite me occasionally, but I don't know today that people didn't love me. I think that they always did, and I just was not receptive to that. I can recall a time in about the third grade that had a teacher that walked in the room. In the classroom, we had a nun early during the day, and she would come in and she'd turn the fan on. And in the middle of the day, we had another teacher that came in, and she wanted the fan off. Well, see, the only problem was the nun turned it on, and she said nobody could touch it. And the other teacher said it had to be off when she came in. Now, you know, I was above average intelligence like most alcoholics all my life, and I knew if the nun didn't turn it off, it wasn't going to be turned off. So the second teacher came in, and she told us all to write 50 times, "I'll turn off the fan before Miss Burley comes in the classroom." Now, that was okay for everybody else, but me and little Billy Smith, you know, everybody's got a little Billy Smith in their class, and me and little Billy Smith, we stood up and said, "We won't write it 50 times." And she said, "Okay, y'all can write it 100 times then." And little Billy, he was a little smarter than I was, and he sat down and started writing. And I told her, I didn't care how many times, she could make it 500 times, I wasn't writing it. And she said, "Okay, you can write it 500 times. And I told her that was fine. And everybody else in the class went to write and punish work, and by the end of class, whatever they had written, if it was just 10 times, that's what their punish work was. They turned it in and they were done, and mine hadn't even begun yet. That was on a Friday afternoon. She called my mother Sunday and told her that you would not believe the look in his eyes. And she assured her that, yes, I would believe it. I've seen it a number of times. So needless to say, I had to write 500 times this little sentence, and I had to do that on Sunday night to have it ready for school Monday morning, and I was up pretty late that night writing. My last little dig at authority with that little incident was that I wrote it 500 times on one piece of notebook paper, and I wrote around the holes and 10 times to a line, and I crammed it in there, and when I laid that piece of paper, or when I threw it on the teacher's desk Monday morning, it rolled up. It just had so much ink on it, it wouldn't lay out flat. And I showed her. You know, I started in Pee Wee baseball. It was my first sport. I was always an overachiever. You know, I was raised in the Catholic Church, and I was an altar boy. I not only was an altar boy, I was the best altar boy. And I was in the Cub Scouts, and I was the best Cub Scout for a while. And then I was in the Boy Scouts, and I was the best Boy Scout for a while. And I joined Pee Wee baseball somewhere in grade school, and I played baseball till I knew I was the best on the team, and I quit. And I went over to basketball, and I played basketball till I knew I was the best on the team, and I quit. And then I played football for about a year, and I played till I knew I was never going to be the best on the team. And I quit. All my life, it was all or nothing, and that was kind of the way I was. And see, the reason I go back and tell some of that is because that's where my problem began. I'm a believer in what the book teaches me, that I'm not a result of the things that happened to me as a kid or in my life. I'm a result of the way I reacted to things. And see, I always reacted different than other kids. I can remember my parents used to call us in the home there, and they'd sit all four of us down, and they would say, "These are the new rules around the Hess house." And my two brothers and my sister would all say, "Yes, ma'am," or "Yes, sir," whichever one was talking to us. And I always said, "Why? Why is it going to be this way?" They called us in one day and asked us, just on a hunch, my mother seemed to get those hunches at times, and she asked us, "Have we been smoking?" You know, moms don't ask you if you've been smoking unless they know. And I knew that, so we all said yes, and she grounded us, every one of us, for a month. And my two brothers and my sister, they learned a good lesson from that. They learned, don't smoke. And I learned a good lesson from that, too. Don't tell them if you do. My perception always was messed up. I started drinking when I was 9 years old, and the way that I did that was I had a good friend of mine at school that would steal liquor from his parents' liquor cabinet. Somehow he learned to pick the lock, and we'd get us a drink out of there, and he'd bring it to school, and we'd drink it on the recess grounds at school or on the walk home from school. And you know, it never was enough to get anybody drunk because it'd be two or three of us splitting it, and he'd bring it in a cough syrup bottle or some kind of a medicine bottle, whatever he could get to bring it in, and we'd drink that out there on the recess grounds. And a lot of times we drank it on the walk home from school, and Had about a 3.5 mile walk home from school. Took us about 45 minutes on the days we drank. And had a little store that you could stop in Memphis there, and they'd sell you 2 cigarettes for a nickel. Now, if you don't think this 9-year-old boy drinking whiskey and smoking cigarettes walking down the street was bad, all you had to do was ask him, and he'd have told you. And, you know, suddenly I was the best football player, and music sounded good even at 9 years old, and the little girls looked much better at 9 years old with a little drink of whiskey. And it never was enough to get anybody drunk, but it always made me feel good, and I liked it. And, you know, I found out that people had lied to me about it. They always told me, if you drink that stuff, you're going to be in trouble. And I wasn't. You know, I'd smoke those cigarettes and chew bubble gum, and I knew stay away from the house long enough that I didn't ever get caught. And things were fun, and it was good, and I enjoyed it. And I don't think I ever had any real problem with it till I was probably about 14. Excuse me. And by the time I was 14 years old, I was beginning to have some pretty serious blackouts, all-day type blackouts. And see, 14-year-old kids can't get by with a whole lot of that. I remember one of the things I used to do to kind of blow my horn and make it look like Mike was not such a bad guy was that I liked to do charity work. And I used to do some out at a place outside of Memphis called Arlington that had a mental institute, you know, and they housed retarded children. And I would go out and play Santa Claus around Christmas, and I always enjoyed doing that. It was one of those bright moments in my early days. One of the things that I got into was, I'm sure everybody knows of Jerry Lewis's telethon and Jerry Lewis's kids. And I at one time got involved in a summer camp that they had for those kids, and I was a counselor. I was a counselor for Jerry's kids, except the kids I was counseling were about 3 to 4 years older than I was. And we had the opportunity to spend a week with these kids during the summer. And after a week of not being able to drink anything, we decided we were going to have a party the day that all the kids went home. So they were leaving on Saturday morning, and we were going to stay to Sunday morning. We figured Saturday night would be a good time to have a party. And one fellow left, and he came back, and he offered to bring us some beer or whatever we wanted to drink when he got back. And I bought me a case of beer, and I hid it up under my tent, platform tent. And this was the middle of summer. And I stuck it up under there on a Saturday morning, and I got started drinking on it Saturday night. Needless to say, it was good and warm. And I remember getting into my first six-pack, and that's all I remember. Of course, I finished the case. I woke up the next morning in a sleeping bag on the front porch with a young lady in my sleeping bag. She wasn't that young. She was a little older than I was. And I had no idea what was going on. There were about 2 or 3 other couples out on this front porch. And needless to say, I drank a case of beer the night before. I had to hit the bathroom pretty quick. And I leaped out of my sleeping bag, and I realized I didn't have any clothes on. And, so I leaped back in my sleeping bag. And I grabbed me some clothes and put them on and went to the bathroom, and I was standing there, and I thought, you know, I might have just lost my virginity and don't even remember. Of course, that was not the last thing I missed out on in life, but it was one of those I'd have liked to have been there for. And still today have no idea what happened. But that's kind of the way things went for me. You know, I'll share this briefly, that around the age of 15, you know, I was one of those that did a lot of drinking. I ran with a lot of guys with long hair, and they smoked pot, and they did all kinds of drugs. And I told them that was fine. Y'all do your drugs, and I'm going to drink, and that's okay with me. And I skipped school one day, and a guy asked me if I wanted to try some marijuana, and I said, sure. Like I had smoked it all along, and I tried it. And I said, well, that's okay. I'll smoke pot, and I'll drink, and I won't do anything else. And then somebody offered me some acid one day, and I took it. And I said, well, I'll do these three, and I won't do anything else. And somebody offered me some speed one day, and I took it. And I said, well, I'll do these, and I won't do anything else. And I ended up taking all kinds of pills and eventually decided, at least I'm not a junkie. I don't stick a needle in my arm and never will. And eventually I did. And so today I hope I've learned that not to say I'll never do anything, because I just don't know. My hope is that I'll die sober and not have to use anything the rest of my life. But I'm not going to tell you I never will, because that's not worked for me. I was about 16 years old, and I met my first wife. It was one of those real romantic situations that alcoholics tend to get in. You know, I was standing in a line at the fair in Memphis, and I noticed this bunch of girls that were standing there. So we went and jumped the fence, and we waited on them inside. And when I got in there, I noticed that she told me that they had all taken some acid. Well, we had too, you know, so I fell in love. And I knew this girl can do the things I can do, and I like her. And we dated for about a year, and she turned up pregnant. Of course, I had some responsibility with that, but I just kind of shunned it. And we decided that, by God, we ought to get married. And I had dropped out of school. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. You know, I was always an overachiever. I went from in the ninth grade being a straight A student to the 11th grade of being a straight F student. And sometimes the F's that I got when I dropped out of school, were a lot of them were zero F's. They weren't 34s or 60s or any of those. They were zeros. And they don't give you any grade when you don't come to class. And I'd missed 90-something days my junior year, and we hadn't finished the year yet. Some of those days I missed because I'd rather go to the park and drink all day, and sometimes I missed because I physically couldn't get out of bed in the morning. And so I decided to drop out of school, get me a job, and go to work, learn the world. A few short months later is when she got pregnant, and we decided to get married. And, you know, I put my thinking cap on like I tended to do when I was drinking, and I best I could come up with was, you know, I had a good job. I was delivering flowers. I was making about $2.50 an hour. It was time to raise a family. And so that's what we did. We had us a beautiful little girl. God only knows why. She wanted to settle down and become a mother and become a wife. And I had learned one real quick lesson about moving out and starting a family was that I was on my own. No longer could anybody tell me what to do. And that's what so I took advantage of that. And I drank daily, nightly, afternoonly, every day. And I had my priorities. I'd pay off my bar tab, and then I'd go buy groceries if we had anything left. And we rolled along in this stormy marriage for about a year or so, and I flipped from job to job. I lost that good job delivering flowers. It didn't take long. I had lots of different kinds of delivery jobs, and the last one I ended up in was a bakery. And I worked there about 2 months, and they let me go. And we were living in a little duplex, and it cost us $118 a month, and that included utilities, so you know it was a nice place. And I looked around one day in our furniture, and we had a fold-out couch that my sister gave us, and it was worn out. And she had a bedroom suite that her parents gave her, and we had found a stereo on the side of the road. It didn't work, but it was a piece of furniture. And we found a coffee table, had three legs, and we used it. I put a milk carton, I believe, under one corner, and we had a black and white TV, had that custom knob, you know, had a pair of ice grips hanging off of it. When I lost that job at the bakery, I looked around and, you know, I thought, I'm about to lose all this. I stayed unemployed about 2 months, and I got panicky. And I decided that the best thing I could do was head to New Orleans because I'd heard there was work down there. And really, I heard there's a lot of drinking down there too, so it enticed me a little bit. And I thought, you know, if I could get away from my family a little bit and go make some money and do a little drinking without anybody leaning over my shoulder, I'd be okay. And somehow, the day before I moved, my father-in-law called me, and he said he had a job for me in a plant there in Memphis, and they had a real strong union. And best I could figure, you know, maybe if I got in with a real good union, I could drink the way I wanted to at work, and they couldn't fire me. So I went to work for a place called Firestone in Memphis, and I became a tire builder. And on the days they kept me sober, I was probably one of the best they had. I had lots of days where I broke all kinds of records building tires, and then some days when I was real messed up, I could break records building tires. And I went to drinking full time then. I was making good money, and I could afford it. I could afford a little more drinking, and I rarely drew a sober breath from there till the time I got sober. And my relationship with this wife began to get real crazy. I had a couple of times we were together that I had real long hair when I was drinking, and I had it probably halfway down the middle of my back, and I looked kind of wild anyway, and I really related to Franklin last night when he was talking about drinking and listening to music and crying, because boy, when I got drunk, it was one of my favorite things to do. I loved to get by myself and cry and drink, you know, cry and drink. And it didn't matter what kind of music it was. It didn't have to be good, slow, old, emotional songs. It could be good, fast rock and roll, and I'd just sit and just cry and listen to the song. And I remember one night that I was laid in the middle of my living room floor, and I was crying, and I was drunk. My daughter and my wife were sitting in the living room watching me, and I had gotten sick in the middle of the living room floor. I had rolled over and got it matted in this long hair, and this wife that I was living with would not even help me get to the bathroom to wash it out, and I couldn't. I was in such a shape I couldn't even crawl. So I had to sleep that way that night in the middle of that living room floor, and I was a little embarrassed, and I was a whole lot angry when I woke up the next morning. And it came another day where I went out to a bar, and I had begun to get real violent when I drank, and I went out to a bar one night, Club Kaiser in Memphis, and this guy named Paul Kaiser owned the place, and it was a real rock and roll type bar and lots of partying and drinking going on. And I went in there one night and I had taken a handful of pills and I was drinking tequila that night. So when I went in, I thought I had spent about 5 minutes in this bar, and they told me I was there 2 hours. And I don't know what I stirred up, but when I got ready to leave, I passed a table full of kids. I call them kids. I was probably 19. They were probably 18. But I passed them, and I saw this girl sitting at the end of the bar, or at the end of the table, and I asked her if she had seen this other girl that I was had been hitting on a lot. And she said no, and her boyfriend hollered something at me, and I did what I usually did when people hollered at me. I shot him a bird and walked on. And I walked out in this little alley to get in my car, and me and one buddy I was with, and somebody tapped me on my shoulder. And I turned around, and there were about 12 guys standing there. And I said, could I help you? And he said, yeah, you the guy that gave me the finger in the bar. And I said, are you the one that smarted off to me? And he said, yeah. And I said, yeah, I'm the one, yeah. And he said, well, I think we need to teach you a lesson. And I said, well, wait a minute. And I said, anybody can see I can't whip all 12 of y'all at once. But if y'all will divide up in teams of four, we'll stay out here as long as it takes. So needless to say, my buddy didn't have any problem convincing him I had lost my mind. And they decided they'd let me get in my car. And somewhere down the line, they decided after all that they didn't want me to leave. And they lined up a line of them across the little alley going to block me in there. And I panicked and I decided I was leaving regardless. And I floorboarded the car and I came through them, and they scattered trying to run, and I picked as many as I could get with one hit, and I ran over them. And I sent bodies flying everywhere. And I, you know, This whole night is basically a blackout to me, except this very short scene. And it's one of those that God let me remember to see those bodies flying. So it haunts me today. It still does. I have no idea who the guys were. And the next thing I remember was waking up the next morning. They said that I came back through the parking lot 3 or 4 more times chasing people that were trying to help the people that I'd run over initially, and that I had broke some bones, and that some people were in the hospital behind it, and that they weren't going to come find me because they'd heard I was in a motorcycle gang. And so my life had gotten crazy. It had gotten crazy, and I was beginning to get scared of myself. I decided, you know, this wife woke me up the next morning and hollered at me, and I was all hungover. And, you know, you don't holler at a drunk the next morning. And she did, and she said, "What did you do the night before?" And I didn't have any idea. And she said, "There's blood all over the car." And my first thought was that I had killed somebody, and I knew terror like I never had known it before. So I got on the phone and I found out that everybody was not okay, but that nobody was dead and that things were going to work out. And I began to daily walk in terror of running into some of these guys or being locked up or killing somebody. And I drank to cover all that up. I decided, you know, that I had taken all the abuse I was going to take from this wife. She wasn't going to holler at me about running over people, and she wasn't going to let me lay on the floor like that anymore. I decided to leave her. And I went out one night after I told her that to a bar. And I had hit one of those places that had a happy hour. Now, most of the time, those places wouldn't let me in there. And I don't know how I got in this place this night. But they let me in. And I was sitting at the bar drinking. And this little blonde walked by. And she had a diamond ring on every finger. And I liked her. And I asked her if she wanted to leave the bar with me. And she said, yeah. And I explained to her, you know, that I had just told my wife I wanted a divorce and I was going to leave her. And she thought I had laid a real good line on her. But, you know, I explained to her that I'd been married since I was 17 years old, and I was about 20 then, 21, now 22. And that I didn't even want to date anybody seriously, and I knew that I never would get married again. So I went home with that woman that night, and I stayed 8 years. We were together about a year and a half, and, you know, I liked her. She was drinking and doing the things I was doing, and once again, it was one of those romantic situations, and we just decided to stay. And I drank those rings up in the first year, every one of them. Somehow I held on to this job during all this time. This union kept me from getting fired. I'd been laid off and reprimanded and suspended for everything that they had in the book a number of times. And we stayed together for about a year and a half. We were married for about 6 months of that time. I went out on a Saturday morning to a well-known place called Counts, Tennessee. And we went up to Counts, Tennessee and built something. There's not but about 10 buildings probably in the whole place, and I built one of them, and I have no idea what it is. But we went up there to build something, and I got up that morning, and I started taking hands full of pills and started drinking beer. And I drank a case of beer before noon, and I don't know how much more I drank that night. And I took me another handful of pills to get me to sleep that night. Sunday morning rolled around, and I got my first trip to ski. Some buddies of mine had a boat, and they wanted to teach me how to ski. Now, you know, I had been drinking daily for a couple of years at that time or longer, and I was in no shape to even walk most of the time, much less get up on a pair of skis behind a boat. But they took us down to a place called Arca Butler and drug me around that lake like a buoy. They put a life jacket on me so I wouldn't sink, and I couldn't keep the skis on, and I didn't have sense enough to let go of the rope, and they drug me around the lake. And I drank, and they drug me, and I drank, and they drug me. And I got home that night, and, you know, I was bad to get depressed and cry when I was drinking, and I hit one of those depression spots. And that afternoon, my second wife told me at 23 years old that she was going to leave, that she'd had all she could stand in a year and a half. And see, I realized I was running through them pretty quick. And You know, at 23 years old, it didn't take a genius to figure out I had filed a form of bankruptcy. I had a six-year-old daughter who I rarely saw and didn't know anything about. I was fixing to lose my second wife. And my job was calling me up to the office on average probably at least once a week and begging me, please don't come to work drunk anymore. Please get on some kind of anti-abuse program. Please do something about your drinking. It didn't take a genius to figure out I had a problem. And so I went over to my parents' house, and I don't know why I did this. I still today don't know why I did this. I need to back up for just a second. About the age of 19, when I was with my first wife, I came home from work one day and did my natural routine. I slapped my wife around, and I got my baby and got in my easy chair. She got scared and she called my mother. My mother told me to put the baby down, and for some reason I listened to my mother still. I guess because she was the only one in the family that would talk to me anymore. And she told me to put the baby down and go to bed, and I did. And they said that I woke up sometime during the night and told them I was an alcoholic at 19 years old and I needed some help. And they sent me to AA. And I went with an uncle of mine and my aunt and my wife at the time, and they took me to 2 weeks worth of night meetings, 8 o'clock meetings. And see, the best I could remember at the end of that 2 weeks, I had been to 3 noon meetings by myself. So you know I didn't hear a whole lot because I didn't even recognize the difference in the lighting in the noon meeting and the 8 o'clock meeting. So I didn't hear about anything, and I decided at that time that I probably was an alcoholic and I'd quit drinking and just smoke pot. Now, it didn't last any time before I was back into my drinking. So when I, at 23 years old, decided it was time to do something about it again, I talked to my brother and my little brother and my mother. And they told me about a treatment center in Memphis. And the best I could tell was this place had tennis courts and a swimming pool. And it was nice. And they fed you 3 times a day. And it kept you 30 days, and if I got in there, I wouldn't have to listen to this wife anymore, and she wouldn't be able to bug me for 30 days, and my boss wouldn't be able to call me, and it was a 30-day vacation. I said, hey, sounds good to me. And I had no intentions of stopping drinking. I had no intentions whatsoever. See, I'd tried AA, and it didn't work, and I'd tried church, and it didn't work, and I tried a lot of things. One old guy, when I was 19 in an AA meeting, one of the very few things that I can remember from those meetings told me just this. He said, you know, you're too young to be having the problems you're talking about. And I'd heard them talk about divorces and losing jobs and going to jail and being locked up in institutions. And some of them even talked about shock therapy. And I thought, you know, that's a good place for all those old drunks. But the thing that shocked me was that all of them were at least 150 years old. When he told me that, that's all I needed, and I hit the door. Here at 23, I couldn't do all that because, see, I'd been to jail, and I'd had the divorce by then, and I had lost some jobs, and some things had changed since the time I'd been in there before. And I had begun to experience some of the things they had talked to me about. And I knew I was hurting. And I knew I wanted to quit hurting, but I wanted to do that and be able to drink. So I went off in this treatment center, and if my counselor walked in here today, I couldn't tell you which one he was. I don't even remember his name. I don't remember anything that happened in group therapy or those classes that they made us go to and any of the lectures. I can't remember any of that. One of the very few things that I do remember is that these people carried me back to AA. And my first thought was, you know, I did this once before and it didn't work. My second thought was these people have gotten younger. They're probably 75, most of them. And they didn't look near as old. And I could identify. I could identify with what the things that they were talking about. When I left this treatment center, one of the few things they had given me was they told me, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I thought, well, that sounded real stupid. But every time I ever left a doctor before or left a hospital, they'd always give me some kind of prescription, you know, and I was quick to take those. So I figured maybe this was my prescription, take a meeting a day for 90 days. And they told me if it didn't work that they'd double the misery back in 90 days and I could have it all back. And so I figured, you know, why not? Why not give this thing a try? He told me to get a sponsor. He told me to pick somebody that I could relate to, somebody that I could identify with, and somebody that had something I wanted. So I got out in the meetings, and I looked around, and I found this guy had a yellow Cadillac, and he had a lot of gold jewelry, and I wanted what he had. And I figured I could identify with him. He was Jewish, and I was Catholic. He owned his own business, and I worked in a sweatshop. We had a lot in common. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and he talked real good. I mean, he talked good AA, and I was interested in some of that. He told me to go to meetings, and so I did that. I did that on a daily basis. And he told me to read the big book, and, I could not hardly keep my attention span in a book that didn't have naked women in it at that time, so I just wasn't going to read my big book. I tried it, and I'd get frustrated, and I'd try it, and I'd get frustrated, and I couldn't comprehend anything, so I chunked the book aside, and I figured 2 out of 3 wasn't bad. I'd go to my meetings, and I got a sponsor, and he told me don't drink, and I didn't do that. So I hung in the meetings, and I was hooked in with a noon meeting, and most of these noon meetings were business people. And the guys would come in there in their three-piece suits, and the women were little old ladies with blue hair. And then there was me. And I was 23 years old, and I had this hair down the middle of my back, and I had this diamond earring, and my favorite shirt to wear was one that said Born to Raise Hell and had a big picture of the devil on it. And I had me some high tops that had holes in them, and they were the only shoes I had. And I had some blue jeans, and all of them, both pair I think that I had holes in them. And that's the way I went to meetings. And see, I kind of stuck out right when I walked in the door. And I liked it. I liked it. It riled them. It got me some attention. I'd sit in these meetings, and these guys with these three-piece suits or these ties on couldn't tell me anything. They didn't know anything. And they would sit and they would talk and they'd bring up a subject and it'd be something nice like serenity. Or they'd talk about humility and they'd say the sweetest, nicest things as they go around the room and then they'd get to me. And I loved it. You know, I would go to ranting and cussing and raising Cain and tell them I didn't know what they were talking about and I wanted a drink and that I was glad to be there. And they would say things like, we love you, Mike, and you just keep coming back. And I thought, this is a weird bunch. But you know, I knew they meant that. I knew that they loved me because it's been a long time since anybody told me to come back. And they meant it. And I started latching on to some of these older guys in the meetings. And we rolled along, stormy and steamy, and they tolerated me for that first year. And I went to a little group that we had a little coffee pot in the back that was one of these pouring coffee pots. And I'd volunteer every day to pour everybody in the room coffee because I couldn't sit for a whole hour. And so I just stayed active pouring everybody's coffee. And it kept me busy for that hour and it kept me in the room for that hour. Otherwise, I'd have to get up and leave. I remember somewhere around 8 or 9 months, I'd been rolling along for a while. See, in Memphis there, they give you a lighter at your first year, when you celebrate your first year, and it's got your name and the serenity prayer and your birth date on it, your sobriety date on it. And I knew that I was going to probably make a year, and I began to wonder, who's going to give me my lighter? I hadn't got a home group. So I picked me a home group, and it was the best one in Memphis. It just happened to be, and it was strictly by luck, and it was Traditions Group in Memphis, and there was a bunch of hard case old alcoholics over in that room that really latched on to me. And they didn't tolerate any of that BS that I was putting out there, and they pretty much snapped me in line. And they began to teach me the steps and teach me how to read that book and why to read that book, and they taught me about sponsorship, and they allowed me to empty the garbage after the meeting, and they showed me how I could wash ashtrays and coffee cups. They had the old glass coffee cups, and I began to find out what a home group was about. I rode along like that for a while, and somewhere around 2 years, I had kind of had a real stormy time with it. And around 2 years, I went to a meeting with a guy that I've been riding the meetings with quite a bit, and we had begun to talk, and this guy just frustrated me to no end. You know, I'd go in there and I'd catch him and I'd say, you know, you won't believe what this wife of mine is like. I just don't know how anybody can stay sober living with her. And I'd rant and rave about her for about 5 minutes. And when I get through, he'd say, you know, Mike, the big book says this about you. I think he's not listening to me. And I'd tell him about this job I had, you know, and I'd tell him how rough it was and how much drinking and drugging was going on in this place and how rough it was for me to have to go to work and tolerate them every day. And he'd say, well, you know, Mike, the big book says this about you. And then I knew he wasn't listening to me. See, I wasn't talking about not drinking. I was talking about these jerks that I was having to live with out here and having to tolerate every day. And he always seemed like he could turn it back to me and make Mike take a look at Mike. So we went to a meeting on my second birthday, and I was so full of hate and so full of revenge and so full of resentment that night that I couldn't even tell you what the topic was. I couldn't have if you asked me right after we left the meeting. And he asked me, we went out and got in his pickup truck, and this fellow's bigger than I am. Went out and got in his pickup truck, and he said, what is the matter with you? And I said, well, I'm just kind of fed up again. And I'm ready to cash my chips in again and get me a drink. And I don't think I belong in this program, and I don't think I like it, not even a little bit. And I think I'd rather be drunk. And he said, well, let me ask you something, Mike. He said, have you ever done any praying? And I said, no. And he said, are you working the steps? And I said, no. And he said, are you reading your book? And I said, no. And he said, well, I know you got a sponsor, but I know you don't use him either. And he asked me a couple other things, and the answer was no. And then he began to laugh, and see, it wasn't funny, the way I could tell. And if he hadn't been so big, I believe I'd have took a poke at him, but he was bigger than I was, and I was sober enough not to do that, so I... not that I was above taking a poke at somebody, but that I wouldn't do it if somebody was bigger than me. So I asked him, I said, you know, you didn't ask me about going to meetings. I go to a lot of meetings. And he said, yeah, but you know what? This program's not going to rub off on you. You're not going to get it. It's not going to soak up sitting in a meeting. He said, you're going to have to take some action. And he said, if you don't, you're going to get drunk anyway, and it won't be your choice. And so, I thought, this guy has really got his nerve. He doesn't ever listen to me. He always tells me about that big book. And so I asked him to be my sponsor that night. And that had to have been God doing for me what I wouldn't do for myself. I think that from that point on, things in AA began to change for me. You know, somewhere around a year sober, I had not prayed in this program probably ever. And I was one of those that sat in the meetings early on, and if you talked about God, I left. As a matter of fact, I had a girl in my group who just jokingly one night looked over at me and she said, before the meeting started, nobody else even heard this. She didn't put me on the spot or embarrass me or anything. She looked over at me quietly and said, Mike, this one's going to be for you tonight. It's going to be on spirituality. I looked at her and I said, okay. And I put the big FU on her and I walked out the door. And that's the way I felt about it. And I used to rant and rave when they would talk about God or spirituality because I knew it didn't have any place in here around all these new drunks. They just couldn't handle it. And there was an old man in the meeting that told me one time, he said, you know, Mike, if God chases them out of these rooms, whiskey will get them back in here. And I believed that. And so I began to let them go on about their God and their spirituality. And then I grew to a point where I could listen to them talk about it and not be so riled about it. And then it grew to a point where I could listen to it comfortably. And it's grown to a place today where I can talk about it comfortably. I think that the earliest recollection that I have of beginning to find God in this program was about a year sober. I got a call from my parents, and they asked me if I'd come by the house, and I went by there. My mother had told me when I was about 18, she said, Mike, I hope that you don't have to have some kind of a tragedy in your life to let you find God. You know, and I give her the standard alcoholic answer. I told her, nothing's going to happen to me. You know, nothing's going to happen. And she said, you know, there are other people in your life that this tragedy could happen to, and I just hope a tragedy doesn't have to happen. But, you know, I was drinking still, and I had several years of drinking after that, and that went right over my head. When I reached about a year sober, I got this call, and they asked me to come by, and I went by the house. And I went in and my ex-wife was there, my first wife, the mother of my child, and I knew something had happened with my daughter, and she was about 7 years old at the time, and they told me to sit down, that they had to talk to me, and I told them, no, I wanted to stand up and hear. And they told me that had I not been sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, they would not have called me and told me anything, but they figured that maybe I was sober enough to handle it today. And they told me my daughter had been molested, and I used to get emotional about the pain. But the tears that come today are from what happened after that. What I did was go to a back bedroom, and I decided it was time for me to do some things that this program had talked to me about. And what they told me was to lean on them. And I called my sponsor, and he was out to lunch. And I called my uncle, who had been in the program for a while, and he was out to lunch. And I thought, this is hell. I'm calling my higher power in this program, and he's out to lunch. And I looked around, and I decided, maybe I'll take one step further. And for the first time sober, our first time in many years even, not just sober, I hit my knees. And I didn't know how to pray. And I remembered, y'all had told me, keep it simple. And I got to thinking about this, and I knew the guy that did it, and I thought, my first thought was, I'll kill him. And I knew if I did that I'd go to prison, and that didn't scare me that bad. And I knew if I went to prison that I could justify drinking in the prison, and that scared me that bad. And so I hit my knees, and I asked God very simply, please take away this anger, because these people in AA tell me that this kind of anger will make me drink. And I don't want to do that. And God loved me enough at that moment to do just that. And I don't think you could have made me mad the rest of the night. I don't think if you'd have hit me with a baseball bat that I'd have gotten mad. I had a calm come over me that I have never known before or since. And I believe that what I experienced was a spiritual experience. And it got me through that day. And it got me to a place where I could handle it the next day, and then the next day, and each day got a little easier. And I had to have a few of those before I understood the reality of this God and this relationship that y'all talked about with him. I was hard to deal with, and there's some guys sitting in this room that know exactly what I'm talking about when I got in this program, and I think it took those kind of things to wake me up. This guy that took hold of me at 2 years sober began to teach me the program, and he walked me through it. He taught me the steps, and he made sure I did them the way the book taught them, and I too was taught to take it on my knees, the third step, and to take it with another person. And see, I'd missed that on my own. I'd missed it completely because I didn't want to see it, I'm sure. And he began to get me involved not only in the steps, but he began to get me involved in this great fellowship of ours. And I lived in Memphis at the time, and he would call me and he'd say, Mike, we're going to a meeting tonight. I'll be by at 7:30. And I'd tell him, you don't understand. I got a basketball game on tonight. And he'd say, I'll be there at 7:30, and he'd hang up. And at 7:30, he'd roll up my driveway, and once again, he was too big for me to argue with, so we went to meetings. And he began to drag me around the countryside and show me the different meetings there in Mississippi and Arkansas, and he did a lot of speaking back in those days, and he'd take me with him every time we talked, and every time he talked, and we'd be standing around after the meeting, the people would come up and they'd say, thanks for talking for us tonight. And then he walked over to me and he said, "We're glad to meet you, Mike. We're glad you're coming back next month to talk for us." And see, that'd been the first I'd heard. So once again, you people and God were doing for me what I wouldn't do for myself. Not that I couldn't, I just wouldn't. And y'all pushed me through this program. I think that, you know, I stayed married to this lady that I had drank all her rings up, and it was stormy the whole time, but we made it somehow. And in about 4 years, she sobered up in the program somewhat, and she began to go to meetings, and she put a lot of her stuff down. And we stayed together, and around 6 years of sobriety, I got an offer to move to Birmingham to go to work for a place. And, I didn't know about that. You know, I was 29 years old, and I was about 6 years sober, and my mother was paying my bills for me for two reasons. One is because the last time that I had checked and gone in and tried to get me a checking account, they laughed me out of the bank 6 years sober. They didn't know what they were doing, obviously. You know, they didn't understand I had 6 years of sobriety. But they wouldn't give me a checking account, so I would carry my paychecks by to my mother's house and she'd pay my bills. Another reason I was kind of glad of that was because I was terrified of getting back in the financial shape that I had been in during my drinking. And I got an offer to move to Birmingham, and you know, I didn't know how I was going to move out from under this cover that I had there in Memphis. I had this blanket of friends in the fellowship, and I had a blanket of protection with my family, and I thought, why not try? So I sent a resume down to Birmingham, and I let it be. First time I'd ever done that in my life. Always before, I pushed things, and I tried to make them happen. And this time, I just decided, we'll see. And I got a call one day in around August of 86, and it was from Birmingham. And they said, come down and see us. And I did, and I looked at Birmingham, and I knew that's where I needed to be. And the only way that I could have made that move was to sell several of the things that I had there in Memphis. A motorcycle, all kinds of appliances, and a lot of things I had to sell because I needed the money to move. And I put that all up for sale, and one guy came by and bought everything that I had, and I knew that just doesn't happen. And he didn't dicker the price. He paid just exactly what I had put in the paper for it. And I thought, you know, that's not supposed to happen. So this must be the right place. And I moved to Birmingham, and with 6 years of sobriety, I thought it would be real easy. You know, I knew some people in the program. I didn't know that they lived 50 miles across town and that I'd never see them in an AA meeting in my end of town. But I felt like it'd be kind of safe. And, you know, I went down there and got involved in another home group, and because I knew the importance of it by then. And I felt somewhat out of pocket at first, but it didn't take me long to get back involved and back and feeling comfortable. A couple of things happened after I'd been down there about 6 months. One is that this lady that I had stayed with for 8 years and had been married to for seven, we finally decided that enough was enough and that the best thing for us to do was part our way. And we did that. And I went down to the bank and I tried to get me a checking account. And they said I had excellent credit and gave me a checking account. And it put my name at the top of some checks. And I don't know whether y'all were impressed with that, but I was darn sure impressed. I'd write checks just for cash, just so I could write them for a while. It felt good to pay all my money out of my checking account and pay the bills. You know, even if I didn't have a dime left, it felt good because I was beginning to be responsible. And that was only because of AA. The last few years down in Birmingham have been up and down, and that's been strictly because of me. When I don't work this program, I pay a price. When I become involved and I do the things that I've been taught to do, then things run good. And I have to remember that. I have to remember that. I've been in a bad way with AA here lately. I just have. And I've sat in meetings here lately and just thought I'm just fed up. And I think it's a lot of what Franklin had mentioned last night. And that's, you know, I don't know what book some of the people are reading from. They quote out of a book that's not in the book that I've got. And I hear people talk about things that got no business being talked about in meetings. And I, you know, and then I have to remember that nobody appointed me president. Nobody appointed me God, and then if I'll focus on me and take care of me, things seem to run a little better. But then I also know that I have a message to carry on and that I have a responsibility to teach AA to the brand new people the way it was taught to me. And teach is probably not a good word, probably share the way it was shared with me. But I have that responsibility, and some days I fall real short of that responsibility. And if I've gotten anything out of this weekend, that's one of the things I want to take back with me, is to get back to being responsible. Not critical and judgmental, but responsible. I had a lady that celebrated 12 years of sobriety the same day that I celebrated 3, and we celebrated together. And she was from Memphis, and she has since passed on since I moved to Birmingham. And I can't even remember her name. We were not real close, but she shared something with me at that birthday meeting that I continue to use, and that's this. And I will share this in closing. I used to go to bed at night, and I thanked God for showing me back to AA. I thank God for showing me back to AA. And today I have to add to that I thank AA for showing me back to God, because that's where the answer to my problems lie. And if I can remember that, I can stay sober. I want to thank y'all for being here, and I want to thank you for your support. Thanks for asking.